From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! President Clinton urges Democrats to vote their conscience today as the House of Representatives decides whether to launch an impeachment inquiry, though it is a foregone conclusion. As Clinton fights to keep his job, a conversation with the Assistant Secretary General of the United Nations, who just resigned from his, saying Iraqi sanctions kill more than 5,000 children a month. And Jennifer Horbury holds a news conference in Washington in the case of murdered Guatemalan Bishop Herardi. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. U.S. Secretary of Defense William Cohen says NATO has amassed an air armada of some 430 warplanes to bomb Yugoslavia if it does not meet U.N. demands to defuse the crisis in its Kosovo province. U.S. defense officials said NATO could issue an activation order authorizing the alliance commander for Europe, General Wesley Clark, to start military action at the time of his choosing as early as this weekend. Meanwhile, most main Western embassies evacuated non-essential staff and dependents from Belgrade today, fearing reprisals if NATO launches airstrikes. Brazil's newly re-elected President Fernando Cardoso has urged his country to support the austerity measures he says are critical to boosting the troubled economy of Latin America's largest country. Federal prosecutors yesterday told a jury that former Pentagon lawyer Teresa Squillicote and her husband, Kurt Stan, conspired to commit espionage, attempted espionage, and illegally obtained national defense documents, charges that could bring a maximum sentence of life in prison. The two were arrested in a sting operation last year that lawyers and supporters describe as illegal. Today, the jury was hearing testimony from an FBI agent who went undercover to buy alleged state secrets from the couple. During the proceeding, the defense lawyer criticized what he called an out-of-proportion and ultimately fruitless investigation that involved 200 FBI agents and included 15 months of phone taps. The House voted yesterday to name the Central Intelligence Agency headquarters after former President George Bush, as it approved the budget for intelligence activities. The CIA headquarters will now be the George Bush Center for Intelligence. And as we are on the air now broadcasting just before the historic House vote, the Republican-controlled House of Representatives is voting today to launch an impeachment inquiry against President Clinton, the first such hearings since the Watergate scandal. The Republican majority in the House certain to approve the impeachment proceedings. Prison authorities yesterday transferred Lori Berenson, an American woman serving a life sentence for treason in a prison high in Peru's frigid Andes Mountains, to another penitentiary for medical tests. Berenson was transferred along with three male prisoners. She has suffered constant health problems during more than 2 years in prison. Her cell has no glass over its window, and the freezing wind means she must sleep under eight blankets. A hooded military judge sentenced Berenson to life in prison for treason on January 11, 1996, for allegedly helping the Tupac Amaru revolutionary movement. Meanwhile, Rhoda and Mark Berenson, the parents of Lori Berenson, will appear in Washington, D.C. today with their legal advisor, Ramsey Clark, and Thomas Nutter for a hearing at the Inter-American Human Rights Commission of the Organization of American States. The hearing is to consider the petition filed on Berenson's behalf by her U.S. legal advisors, along with her Peruvian attorney, on January 22nd, after all legal remedies in Peru were exhausted. Lawyers for Malaysia's most prominent political dissident, Anwar Ibrahim, went to court today to demand his release from indefinite detention. Anwar was arrested in late September under the Internal Security Act, which allows indefinite detention without trial. His arrest came after 2 weeks of rallies where he called for government reform, an end to corruption, and the resignation of Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad. The death toll in the August 7th bombing of the U.S. embassy in Kenya has been revised downward to 213 because some of the bodies were accidentally counted twice. This, according to the head of a relief fund for victims. The new tally brings the number of dead in Kenya and a simultaneous embassy bombing in Tanzania to 224 people, including 12 Americans. The U.S. Embassy in Buenos Aires denied yesterday that Argentina sold arms to Croatia in 1991 with Washington's knowledge or blessing, saying the United States supported the U.N. arms embargo. The arms sales to Croatia during its war of independence from Yugoslavia and to Ecuador in 1995 during its border war with Peru comprise one of the most damaging scandals for the government of President Carlos Menem since his second term began in 1995. Mexican protesters shut down a session of the Supreme Court yesterday after defying the Chief Justice and refusing to quell a courtroom protest while hundreds of fellow protesters besieged the building outside. The unprecedented disruption forced Mexico's highest tribunal to suspend a vote on whether banks can charge compound interest, just as the justices seem set to rule against the protesting debtors and in favor of creditor banks. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, here with Juan Gonzalez. Welcome, Juan.
Good day, Amy, and I'm glad to see that President Clinton has asked the members of Congress to vote their conscience. Now, it may take some of them a while to find it, but but I'm sure they will in time for the vote.
Well, Juan, we're in an uncomfortable position here on Democracy Now! Because the show broadcasts, actually, we do this show just before the vote. It's 9 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, but a lot of stations around the country will be hearing this program after the vote, which is a foregone conclusion in Washington. So we're not going to be spending much time predicting anything today, though, as I said, it is a foregone conclusion, but we will be doing a postmortem tomorrow and looking just in particular how Democrats vote, because that is interesting in terms of races around the country, where they think the sentiment of the people is. But yesterday we did talk to Ralph Nader, consumer advocate and former presidential candidate for the Green Party, about his recommendation for a national advisory referendum on this issue for November 3rd. He says it would be constitutional, a one-time event where you'd have people around the country voting on whether the president should be impeached and Congress taking their advice. We gave out our website and his website, essential.org, to give more information. That's www.essential.org, which is the proposal for the national advisory referendum. We got a lot of response to that. A lot of people are going to the web and looking at this, as people are just fed up with their so-called representatives making decisions on something that everyone in this country probably has an opinion on at this point. And we got this call from one of our listeners, and this call was from New York.
Hi, my name is George Millenbach. I live here in Manhattan, and I was very, very impressed with Ralph Nader yesterday on Democracy Now! Regarding the National Advisory Referendum on Election Day on the matter of the impeachment of President Clinton. I would urge every one of your listeners to call this number. It is the White House comments line in the White House in Washington, D.C. It's area code 202-456-1111. And advise President Clinton to come out and propose this himself. He'll be the only person that everyone in the nation will listen to on this matter. They're not going to listen to senators or the congressmen. They're going to listen to the president. Now, of course, it is self-serving for the president to do this. However, this is the best way. Ralph Nader has come up with the best way to make the people's voice be heard on this. We already know what the polls are like, but the polls is important is on Election Day. And we should shame every one of these senators and every one of these people in the House of Representatives. We should be shaming them if they do not follow the people's voice on Election Day. This can go forward. It just needs someone like President Clinton. He's the only person that anyone will listen to. It's a politically very savvy move on his part. But it'll get this nonsense, this Monica Lewinsky nonsense, behind us and get these people that we elected back to the jobs that they're supposed to be doing instead of diverting attention on this business.
And that was one of our listeners calling in on Ralph Nader's suggestion of a national advisory referendum. What do you think, Juan?
Well, I think it's an intriguing idea. However, I think that the caller said, the best way for people to have a referendum is on when they vote on their representatives in Congress this November to make some substantial changes, because as we've been reporting here on this show, a very important legislation continues to be quietly passed by this Congress while public attention is being diverted to this continuing investigation. The latest, of course, is the whole issue of personal bankruptcies and a giveaway to many of the credit card companies. Rather than regulating their continued exploitation, Congress is now has moved very rapidly, the Republicans, toward a so-called reform of personal bankruptcy laws that would deliver to the credit card companies much of what they want.
And speaking of the credit card companies, the U.S. Justice Department is suing Visa and MasterCard, the largest credit card networks, alleging they restrain competition and limit consumers' choices. Together, the two account for 75% of credit card sales in the United States. In the federal lawsuit, which was filed yesterday in Manhattan, the Justice Department challenged the joint control of credit card networks by the same group of large banks. And, you know, these credit card companies, Visa, MasterCard, et cetera, are the very ones that are pushing very hard on that personal bankruptcy bill. And just a final comment on the whole vote that's going to take place today. It's hard to describe this as historic. It is historic, but you think of historic for very big, big moments. And you think about what's happening in Washington right now and the turmoil over what? But I was looking at the Los Angeles Times that's explaining the whole thing, saying there's little Clinton could do to head off the inquiry that will authorize an open-ended investigation to determine whether he should be impeached for lying about his affair with Monica Lewinsky and allegedly attempting to cover it up. The Republican plan also would authorize the House to consider the impeachment of Clinton for other alleged offenses. Those could include matters that independent counsel Kenneth Starr has been investigating for several years, along with any role Clinton might have played in Democratic Party fundraising abuses. Yesterday, Starr told leading members of the House Judiciary Committee that he could not foreclose the possibility that he would submit to Congress evidence of additional wrongdoing by Clinton. Clinton and his allies are trying to keep Democrats from voting for the resolution so they could portray the decision largely as a partisan matter in which the Republican majority in Congress is not giving the Democratic president a fair hearing. And again, tomorrow on Democracy Now, we will take a look at just how the vote came down, though it is a foregone conclusion now that they will vote for an open-ended inquiry into President Clinton.
Yes, and of course, as we have remarked often on this program, sometimes it is not easy to tell what are the real forces at play in a particular crisis or scandal, Clearly, this battle over Clinton and Monica Lewinsky has gone on for so long that it really is a reflection of deep divisions that exist within the governing elites in this country over the best way to continue to move forward whatever agendas each particular section of the elite is responding to. And this is not merely a sex scandal, but clearly is a reflection of deep political divisions. Just as in Malaysia right now, they're supposedly involved in another sex scandal where President Mahathir is engaged in battles with his former deputy. And in that country, it appears on the surface as a sex scandal, but is also a deep political battle where the United States and other major nations and economic powers have decided that Mahathir really is not in their interests and needs to be unmasked. So suddenly we're getting all these detailed reports in the Times and Washington Post and other major national newspapers about this continuing battle for now it's being couched as democracy going on in Malaysia.
That's right. And the former number two man coming out of prison, all beaten up as well. And Amnesty International, as well as the World Bank president and others, are decrying his abuse. Well, as the rest of the country looks at what is going to happen to our president fighting to keep his job, we're going to take a look today at a man who has decided to give up his. 44 members of Congress this week began a campaign calling for a halt to the economic sanctions against Iraq and have signed a letter to President Clinton asking him to strengthen military sanctions and to eliminate non-military sanctions. Joining us right now is Dennis Halliday. He is also joining them in this campaign. He resigned last week as the United Nations humanitarian coordinator of the Oil for Food program in Iraq. He is the, well, former Assistant Secretary General of the United Nations. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Dennis Halliday.
Thank you very much.
Can you tell us why it is that you resigned?
Well, I found myself in Iraq in a position of, on the one hand, representing the United Nations, overseeing a sanctions regime and the impact of that regime on the people and children in particular. At the same time, trying to oversee a humanitarian assistance program, which was underfunded and over-politicized both in Baghdad and in New York. It's not a very satisfactory situation.
Explain what the Oil for Food program is.
This is a program which was approved by the Security Council, whereby Iraq is able to produce and sell oil up to $2 billion gross every 6 months. And after compensation and other costs have come off the top of that, it leaves $1.3 billion net per 6 months for purchasing basically foodstuffs for the people of Iraq, some 23 million, together with health, drugs, supplies, and some other inputs for agriculture, education, water and sanitation, electric power, but very modest, in fact.
And what was your job there?
My job was to represent the Secretary General to, first of all, observe that this program is working properly. The contracting procurement is carried out by the government itself, and we oversee the distribution through an observer network to make sure the terms of the resolution of the Security Council is applied correctly. In the north of the country, where the Kurdish population lives, some 3 million, we, the UN family, implement the program directly as per instructions of the Security Council.
And Dennis Halliday, how do you estimate, or what is your estimate of the impact of the sanctions day by day in Iraq on the general population now?
Well, the most common feedback on that topic is it relates to death and to malnutrition. And indeed, we see now that children 5 years and under, some 30%, are suffering from malnutrition despite this program. And this looks like it will continue under present funding and arrangements. This also includes chronic malnutrition, which leads to physical and mental stunting, which has horrible consequences for the long term. Furthermore, we see morbidity mortality rates of children under five running at about 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 per month. And according to the World Health Organization, this may well be an underestimate in that rural children are not registered often and then may die before that, in fact, takes place. It's a tragedy of very considerable proportions.
In terms of your resignation, I don't know whether you've already been besieged by requests by the American mass media to be interviewed. I know that when one of the UNSCOM people resigned a few months ago, he was besieged by all kinds of media that wanted to find out what his differences were with the way the United Nations was carrying on the monitoring of the elimination of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Have you been besieged by requests for interviews?
Yes, before I left Iraq, I did a press conference where CNN and many of the regional and the wires, of course, were present. And I've just had the pleasure of being in Washington to speak to a group of some 40 congressmen put together by John Conyers of Michigan. I was invited to meet with Senator Biden. And in Washington, I have done some interviews with CNN again, with PBS, and since then with several radio and television programs.
But I think you hardly got the kind of coverage that Ritter did when he left as an UNSCOM inspector.
Exactly. He certainly was able to influence perhaps more thinking than I so far.
What are the effects of this beyond the malnutrition, as if this isn't enough, the deaths of 6,000 or 7,000 people? This is the question we're going to put to Dennis Halliday in just a minute after stations identify themselves. Again, we are speaking with the former Assistant Secretary General of the United Nations, who resigned last week as the UN's humanitarian coordinator for the Oil for Food program in Iraq, where he spent most of the last year. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, and we'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. Our guest is Dennis Halliday, and he is former Assistant Secretary General of the United Nations, resigned last week as the person in charge of the UN's Oil for Food program in Iraq, where he spent the last year overseeing this. Again, his findings that at least 5,000 children per month under the age of five in Iraq are dying from, would you say, the effect of the sanctions, Dennis Halliday?
Yes, from the impact of deprivation of nutritious and balanced diets and from the lack of health care facilities and health care generally due to damage after the Gulf War and the lack of investment in those sectors since then.
And what's your best guess in terms of the impact, the social and political impact on the Iraqi people in terms of how they are digesting and responding to these sanctions? Are they becoming increasingly, are they increasingly blaming their own leadership, or are they increasingly blaming the world powers in the United Nations or the U.S.?
Well, there are significant social consequences. I think we're seeing that the traditional Islamic and Iraqi family is being severely damaged. There's a brain drain factor. Some 2 to 3 million professionals have been obliged to leave the country to find work overseas. This leaves families with single parent control. Children are finding it necessary to drop out of school, to find work, to become beggars, to become street kids. Young adults are desperately frustrated. They're coming out of the universities with good qualifications but without employment opportunities. Women who have advanced significantly in the last 20 years, the Iran-Iraq war opened up opportunities for professional and other women employment. And that is now going backwards as women can no longer afford to go to work because going to work requires expenditures to a certain extent. And salaries are now down to $2 or $3 equivalent per month, which makes it impossible. I think in terms of governance, there's some expectation that sanctions might in fact turn Iraq into a more democratic participatory system. That clearly is not happening. In fact, the present central government is being strengthened by the presence of sanctions, which create a dependency on the part of the people, which I think is not understood. And perhaps another point of real concern is the psychological. That is the isolation of Iraq and its young people, the future leadership, the young intelligentsia, who now feel increasingly alienated from the rest of the world, Europe, North America, this country in particular, perhaps. And I think that's a dangerous thing for the future. And they are frustrated, angry people who find their present leadership moderate. And they have solutions that they think perhaps would be more effective in dealing with sanctions after 8 years.
Is there any precedence in UN history for sanctions that have lasted this long?
I'm not quite sure about that. I believe this is the longest single application of UN sanctions. I think there have been, of course, bilateral sanctions that have gone on much longer.
I'm looking at a piece in the Washington Post yesterday saying that Iraq may be close to meeting UN demands concerning the elimination of its chemical and ballistic arms, but not of its biological weapons, according to a UN report. Full disclosure by Iraq remains the crucial ingredient for the completion of the disarmament process, the report said. Baghdad has largely refused to cooperate with UN weapons inspectors for the past 2 months, it noted. The report by Richard Butler, executive chair of the UN Special Commission, known as UNSCOM, that's in charge of disarming Iraq under Gulf War resolutions, rejected Baghdad's repeated contention that it's already fulfilled all the Security Council's disarmament requirements. It said Iraq, by demanding that UNSCOM prove Baghdad is continuing to retain forbidden weapons, is reversing the onus of disclosure that the Security Council had placed on Iraq when it demanded a full accounting of its weapons of mass destruction. Did you deal much with Richard Butler when you were in Iraq?
No, he does not reside in Iraq. He lives in New York. He visits for 2 or 3 days periodically. I have no direct connection with Richard or the UNSCOM program. Mm-hmm. We're both UN entities, but we work separately for obvious reasons.
And what do you make of this report, and what will it mean?
Well, I really can't comment. That's an area beyond my terms of reference or my competence, and I would be better off to keep quiet, I think.
Why?
Because I'm not competent to make any sensible observations.
In terms of Secretary General Kofi Annan, of course, he's been in the hot seat now ever since he got into that post. What was his reaction to your resignation, and what do you think are some of the conflicting messages or battles that he is waging personally as a UN leader in terms of being able to maneuver through dealing with the continue what seems to be a never-ending Iraq crisis?
Mm-hmm. Well, I can speak best about the humanitarian program, and the Secretary General was very quick late last year, end of 97, to see the problem and understand the shortfall of this oil for food program, and he agreed very quickly to go to the Security Council asking for a more than doubling of the program, to give Iraq and the UN the resources to bring in all of the multi-sectoral needs that removing malnutrition requires. And I speak of electric power, which is running below 40% since the Gulf War due to damage, water and sanitation, which is a critical factor in child health. Waterborne diseases are killing many infants in Iraq. And thirdly, perhaps a more balanced diet, which would include animal proteins, minerals, vitamins, which are currently missing from the present so-called food basket. So the Secretary General was very quick to take the issue up and push the Security Council into a more generous package. We've been defeated, however, somewhat by the price of oil, which has reduced revenues rather drastically.
Dennis Halliday is our guest. He's the former Assistant Secretary General of the United Nations. Are you getting used to being the former? Well, actually, when is your last day?
Well, in fact, I work through October, but I've given up the Iraq program itself, which perhaps allows me to express my views.
So what do you think, now that you're free to express your views, should happen in Iraq?
Well, I think we will hopefully have this review process within the United Nations, which allows everybody to put on the table their various concerns. I would hope, from the humanitarian point of view, to see economic sanctions removed or eased and setting up some new machineries whereby Iraq can maximize its revenues and bring in the money needed to rebuild the infrastructure, without which we'll never solve the problem of mortality and malnutrition.
What role has the U.S. played in all of this?
The U.S., you know, is one of the oldest friends of Iraq, and most Iraqis have a love affair with this country. Right now they're having difficulty expressing that affection because, of course, the impact of sanctions is now being held at the responsibility of the United States. And Iraqis have great difficulty, I think, with that. And it's most unfortunate, I think, for the long-term relationship between this country and Iraq. It's the most unfortunate development.
And in terms of, you've talked about the social impact, what would you estimate in terms these sanctions have meant in overall movement backward of Iraqi society? Are we talking 10 years lost in terms of 10 or even more in terms of the, because Iraq was one of the most modern and advanced societies of the Arab world?
That's quite correct. I think the country estimates they've lost something like $120 billion due to this sanctions period. Indeed, you're right. The country was a highly developed one with outstanding educational systems, very high quality of health care, a very prosperous population with high quality of high standards of living. So that has crashed now due to the appalling damage of the Gulf War to the country. And to rebuild that is a very long process. And I think we're talking 10 or 20 years, assuming there would be, say, $100 billion available next week. Now, that's not likely to be the case, given oil prices, oil pumping capacity, And the fact the debt burden that Iraq holds today is overwhelmingly large and would need some restructuring. So it's a very critical problem for rehabilitation and development of this country, to restore it to where it once was.
And you mentioned the Kurdish population. I was reading in the paper last couple of days that Congress is voting $100 million in military assistance to the groups that are seeking to overthrow Saddam Hussein. What's the impact on the humanitarian assistance to the Kurdish populations?
Yeah, the Kurdish population in the north, which is about 3 million plus, is getting its humanitarian support directly from the United Nations, as directed by the Security Council. And we are working in the same areas up there of food, health, water sanitation, electric power, including demining, which is uniquely in the north, and also the settlement of displaced persons, of which there are many, many thousand in the north, given the difficulties between the Kurds themselves and the fact that Kurdish people have come back from Iran and Turkey over the years and have been displaced for other reasons in addition. But that allocation of funding, I think, is a totally different issue. The Kurdish relationship with the Baghdad government is an issue of great importance, which I very much hope they will resolve. It's one Iraq. Everybody, I think, feels that, including the Kurds themselves. I think that's the future. One Iraq, Kurdish, Sunni, Shia, and all the other Christians that live in that basically secular society.
Dennis Halliday, being with this world body that happens to reside in New York, you both are part of the larger international community, and you see what's happening in the United States. Of course, the obsession in the United States today and the focus of all of the media and a lot of people is the Clinton sex scandal. How has that affected what's happening, if it has, at the United Nations and even what's going on in Iraq today?
I don't think I don't see any impact of the Washington difficulties on the United Nations or on Iraq. I think really they're unrelated. But I am not here to make a political comment.
Right. I'm just wondering if it has sped things up or slowed things down at the United Nations because the U.S. is such a powerful player.
Mm-hmm. Again, I haven't been in New York for 13 months. This is something way beyond my competence.
Mm-hmm. And finally, are you angry today as you resigned from the United Nations about what is happening in Iraq?
Angry is probably a good word. I think the injustice we see there through sanctions is something we all need to be concerned about. It impacts on regional peace. It impacts on world peace. And I worry that we in the United Nations, we need to pick up on these crises around the world, of which Iraq is one. We need to respond to that for the credibility and the future benign benevolence of the organization in terms of these world situations. It's important to the United Nations itself that we respond and find a better solution to sanctions.
Would you say it's fair to say that the United Nations is responsible for the deaths of more than 5,000 children a month?
The United Nations, in the big sense of the word, which is the member states, Security Council, undoubtedly that is unfortunately correct.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Dennis Halliday, former Assistant Secretary General of the United Nations, resigned last week as the UN's humanitarian coordinator of the Oil for Food program. If people want to find out more about how they can get involved with the issue, you are now joining with these 44 members of Congress in the campaign calling for a halt to the economic sanctions against Iraq. Is there any place that they can call or a body of people that they can turn to?
Well, I think in Washington there are many interested groups, but I think the office of John Conyers is probably the safest place to go. He is very much interested in this issue and wants to raise it with the foreign relations committees, and so perhaps his office is the best place to go.
And Congressmember John Conyers, you can reach him by calling the congressional switchboard at 202-225-3121. That's 202-225-3121. And of course, you can call your own Congress member as well. Thank you for being with us.
You're most welcome. Shama paya tere bina tu garya dodna ro ro ke main deva sada tu garya dodna
Shamapena, tere bina, tu garya dodna.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. And just a related story on the issue of Iraq. Lawyers for six Iraqi dissidents ordered deported by a U.S. judge will go before a Senate subcommittee today to argue that the government had no real evidence against them. A U.S. immigration judge ordered the men deported as national security risks in March, basing her ruling largely on secret testimony by the agents and classified documents. Much of the proceedings were conducted behind closed doors, with even the defendants, who've been held in a federal detention center outside Los Angeles for nearly 2 years, and their lawyers kept out because the government maintained the testimony contained information sensitive to national security. The defendants and their lawyers were allowed to see only portions of the judge's ruling. The six Iraqis were among a group of 600 men, women, and children who fled northern Iraq into Turkey in 96 in the face of the crackdown on his opponents by President Saddam Hussein. And Juan, you may remember when we did interview one of those prisoners, Dr. Ali Yassin Mohammed Karim. Again, he and the five other prisoners testifying before Congress today.
Well, at least that's one story that has gotten much wider coverage since we first reported it.
That's right. Well, some prominent actual Republicans joined on their side and representing them and saying that they should not be deported back to Iraq. Well, right now we're going to turn to something else that is happening in Washington, and it is the World Bank IMF annual meeting that is taking place there. President Clinton addressed the groups on Tuesday, but at the same time where these world economic leaders are gathering and finance ministers, you have groups of activists that have gathered in Washington to protest the policies of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. The International Monetary Fund and World Bank, known much more in the developing world than known here in the United States, although that is where their offices are based. And we're joined right now by one of those people who've come to Washington to talk about international policy and also to talk specifically about debt and Africa. Does Africa owe something to the Western world, or is it the other way around? We're joined in our Washington studio by Kofi Clue. He is head of Uhuru, which is an organization based in Ghana that deals with the issue of debt. He's also on the board of Jubilee 2000, which is a group in this country and around the world that is calling for a forgiveness of debt. We welcome you to Democracy Now!, Kofi Clue.
Thank you.
Well, I got a chance to hear you, Kofi Clue, on Saturday morning in an address you gave at a national meeting of a group of organizations that was put together by the 50 Years is Enough campaign, the idea that 50 years is enough of the World Bank and the IMF, where you specifically addressed the issue of debt.
Yes, I did. And I did from an African perspective, in the sense that there is talk about Africa owing the West so much, you know, in terms of money. And we put it the other way around, looking at the history of the relationship between Africa and Europe and the West. We see that the human and material resources of Africa have been used to develop the West and underdevelop Africa. And whilst, you know, there is talk about Africa repaying so-called debts, there is no talk about the, you know, historical debt that is owed us for centuries of pillage and plunder and destruction of African people worldwide. And we raise these issues, and this is what I spoke to.
And Kofi Clue, in the reports that I've seen in the last couple of days in terms of the World Bank and the IMF, there seems to have been some disagreement between these two bodies. The World Bank apparently for the first time publicly criticizing the policies of the IMF. Is this basically a falling out among thieves, or is this anything that has
precisely
any substance?
You've put it correctly. It's and more so it's a pretense at falling out among thieves, because at the end of the day, both bodies are part of the global machinery of pillage of the peoples of the third world, and they may differ in terms of presentation and approaches, but essentially the objective is the same. We know them as the armed robbers of the peoples of Africa and the rest of the so-called third world.
And in what supposedly is the difference between what the World Bank does and what the IMF does?
I don't know, really. I mean, because we see both of them acting together in concert in promoting the same kind of policies that continue to underdevelop Africa, cause mayhem, destruction, death, and so on. So we don't know the difference in terms of the impact on the lives of us as African people on the continent or the diaspora. We don't know the difference between these two bodies.
Kofi
we
Klu.
See them as hydra-headed monsters.
Kofi Klu, we have to break for stations to identify themselves, but when we come back, we're going to continue this discussion and also find out how you and others are strategizing around the issue of debt and debt forgiveness. Although, forgive me for using that word, because that word, debt forgiveness, this idea that Africa must be forgiven. We're talking to Kofi Klu, who's with Uhuru in Ghana here in the United States as the World Bank and IMF meet in Washington, D.C. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, but we'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. Our guest in our Washington studio is Kofi Klu of the Ghanaian human rights group Uhuru here in the United States in Washington to talk about the issue of African debt as financial leaders of the world gather in Washington for the annual meeting of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. What about this whole use of language when we talk about debt forgiveness and forgiving Africa?
Well, Jubilee 2000 campaign is a worldwide movement which is drawing various forces together globally to campaign for the cancellation of the debts of the so-called third world. And there are, you know, so many terms being used. We in the Jubilee 2000 Africa campaign are categorically against the term debt forgiveness for Africa, because when we look at the historical experience of our historical experience in relation to the West, in relation to the North, we see that we have been more sinned against, you know, than sinning. And we are raising within the context of the debt cancellation campaign the fact that, you know, there is incalculable debt much more owed to Africa and the rest of the so-called third world has experienced colonialism, you know, slavery, and still continues to experience neocolonialism. You know, there is much more owed to us. So there cannot be any talk of, you know, anybody forgiving us. You know, we have to. And we are raising our demand that debt cancellation be seen as part of the reparations owed to us as African people and the peoples of the so-called third world that continue, you know, whose lives continue to be wrecked by imperialism. Let's call things properly. It is continuing imperialism that continue that is destroying our lives through its present phase of neocolonialism in Africa. So we cannot be talking about debt forgiveness and using similar that kind of language in this campaign, and we're categorically against it.
Kofi Klu, I'm much more familiar with how this process has developed in Latin America. For instance, in the early 1980s, many of the major Latin American countries defaulted on their debt, and as part of what was the West called the restructuring of these debts, they were forced to privatize thousands and thousands of publicly owned corporations to devalue their money, so that in effect, the average Mexican, the average Brazilian, the average The average Latin American is actually earning less today than they were 15 or 20 years ago in real terms. What has been the concrete way that that the IMF and the World Bank and these international organizations have affected some of the African countries during this period of the late quarter of the 20th century?
In much the same way as you have described the process in Latin America, we have a situation whereby, because of the debt bondage, the IMF and the World Bank insist, you know, on devising policies like structural adjustment programs that, in effect, mean the destruction of our local economies and opening them up for foreign transnational corporations that actually take control not just of our economies but also of the politics of our countries. We have the imposition through that process of regimes that do no longer represent the interests of our people, but represent the interests of these foreign transnational corporations and Western governments. And we have, you know, to put it, you know, in short, that Africa has lost the little, you know, gains it made of independence in the 60s, and we are back to a situation where there is total ring of neocolonialism, and our governments cannot make any, our so-called governments cannot make any decisions without them being approved by the so-called experts of the IMF and the World Bank with a stamp of Western governments and any kind of regime, because we have had governments that have resisted this approach. Those kinds of governments have been removed through covert and overt operations backed by Western governments, as we have had the overthrow of the government of Kwame Nkrumah in Ghana. We've had the murder of Patrice Lumumba. We've had the murder of Thomas Sankara. These are the kind of processes. So in effect, the impact on Africa is that we have a people who have totally lost the gains that were made in our independence struggle.
Now, is this true in southern Africa as well as the rest of the continent? Because clearly in the 1980s saw the success of the liberation movements in Zimbabwe, in Namibia, and in South Africa. Have those recently liberated countries also fallen under the same sway, or are they still managing to maintain a relative independence against these international finance centers?
Well, I think, you know, even in South Africa actually graphically demonstrates, you know, the problem, because many people do not know that before the ANC led by Mandela were allowed to be part of this so-called process of legally doing away with apartheid, they were made to sign a commitment to pay the debts incurred by the apartheid regime in promoting apartheid. And we have a situation whereby today, you know, so-called independent South Africa cannot meet the demands, the legitimate aspirations of its African majority. It has even abandoned its program of reform, the so-called Reconstruction and Development, you know, plan, precisely because there is the news of the apartheid debts hanging over the so-called government of national unity, and it is incapable of delivering. It is prioritizing paying the apartheid debts owed to the very transnational corporations and institutions of imperialism that had sustained apartheid. And we have the African people of South Africa particularly, you know, having to do away with the benefits they expected to gain from the dismantling of apartheid in order to pay the very corporations and institutions that profited, you know, from apartheid. That is the kind of injustice. And we say that even in South Africa today, you cannot talk about independence when you have a government that is incapable of actually fulfilling the basic cause and for which the people rose constantly in rebellion against the severest repression in struggle against apartheid. That South Africa, more than any other part of the continent, demonstrates that. And even if you look at the neighboring countries like Mozambique, Angola, Tanzania, Zambia, that were in the frontline states that stood together with the liberation movements of South Africa, that is not just the ANC, but also the PAC. We have also the AZAPO. Now, these countries and peoples actually suffered incursions by the apartheid armed forces against them, destabilizing the governments in those countries, wrecking the economy, obstructing development. But those people stood with the liberation movements of South Africa and challenged apartheid. Now, they also are being compelled to pay for debts incurred in promoting the fight against apartheid. This is the kind of gross injustice that the Jubilee 2000 Africa campaign is mobilizing against, to expose and to ensure that this injustice is dealt with.
It's fascinating that you recount this, because I remember that in my reporting in Haiti, the history of Haiti, the same situation occurred in the initial uprising for independence and against slavery, that the French, in order to agree to stop their continued reinvasion of Haiti, reached an agreement with the new Haitian government in the early 19th century that it would repay. It would pay, in essence, a debt to France, which lasted for Haiti throughout the whole 19th century, having to repay France for the fact that it became free. So it seems that the same tactic has continued to be used, as you're saying, throughout Southern Africa.
And you have
precisely.
You have countries like the Congo, former Zaire with Mobutu, who is propped up by the West, propped up by these international financial institutions like the World Bank and the IMF, who incurred a tremendous debt. And then you have the people today having to repay that. Of course, these dictators like Mobutu of Zaire, Suharto of Indonesia, the same situation. You see that the crisis that Indonesia is in today, as they have to repay these debts that are incurred, put into the pockets of these dictators that are propped up by these financial institutions.
Precisely. And we put squarely the present war in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. You know, we put the blame for that squarely on the IMF and the World Bank, because little is known that immediately after the government of Kabila came, after Kabila assumed the reins of government, the IMF and the World Bank demanded that the new government prioritize paying Mobutu's debts. Now, everybody knows that Mobutu had been sustained in government. Precisely, the West and the United States of America was instrumental in keeping that bloody regime in power for all this, against the countless rebellions of the masses of the peoples of the Congo. Now, the Mobutu totally plundered the Congo and allowed foreign transnational corporations to go on a mayhem in that place. Now that through the efforts of the people of the Congo, they have removed the tyrannical regime of Mobutu, they are being compelled to pay that. And it is the reluctance of Kabila to honor these terms that has led to the present debacle, and we are in solidarity with the people of the Congo in their fight to ensure that the debt bondage that was imposed on them through the Mobutu regime is not allowed to strangulate them. You know, these are the glare. But I think that the challenge is for peoples in the West, peoples in the North, to rise in solidarity with peoples in the South when they stand against the mechanisms of global domination, like the debt bondage, because you have recounted the long history of struggle against the debt in Latin America. We have ongoing struggles against the debt in Philippines and other parts of Asia, and we have this growing movement against debt bondage in Africa. Now, people have risen, particularly students, working people, women, have gone into action through various forms of protest actions, demonstrations, rebellions against their bondage. What has been lacking is effective mass solidarity with the peoples of the South. And one of the challenges that we have put before ourselves in building the Jubilee 2000 Global Movement is to develop a South-to-South network of solidarity. And we hope that the peoples of the North, from the grassroots, will join us in making this a massive movement of global solidarity, not just to end debt bondage, but to totally do away with the global economic injustice that is being imposed upon us, which is really dehumanizing humanity as even we are about to enter into this new millennium.
One of the fascinating things that come to mind as I hear you recounting the experiences of Africa and other parts of the Third World is that we just had a crisis here in the United States that almost escaped the whole country, which is that the financial system almost collapsed because one of the major hedge funds couldn't pay its debts. It made so many bets on financial markets all around the world that it was, in essence, bankrupt. And immediately, the Secretary of the Treasury, Rubin, called together, and the Federal Reserve Bank called together some of the major corporations and said, "We can't let this guy not be able to pay his debts. It would wreck the financial system." So immediately, new loans were put together for long-term capital management to keep it in power. Yet when one of these countries of the Third World says, "Listen, we can't pay your debt," immediately they're told, no, you can do anything you want. You can call yourself a socialist, a nationalist, whatever you do, but the one thing you must do is you got to pay your debts.
So there seems to be a continuing double standard.
Yes,
precisely. It is these double standards that the Jubilee 2000 movement is challenging, because right now as we speak, you know, Britain still owes the United States of America, and the United States of America is not rushing in there, you know, asking the World Bank and the IMF to impose the kind of austerity measures that they are imposing on the countries of Africa. So, we recognize very, very clearly that even though Jubilee 2000 is bringing in an ethical edge, you know, to this movement for debt cancellation, we recognize that it is a political struggle. You know, it is a political decision that was made by the United States government to rescue banks, not just here in America, but, you know, all over the world, anytime they run into crisis. Now, we have to build a kind of people-to-people's global movement that would force, you know, the governments to cancel the debts for the unjust debts of the peoples of the so-called Third World. And I think that there is a challenge. We in Africa, we in the so-called Third World, would want to work with the grassroots in the Americas to ensure that this global movement challenges the hypocrisy of the American establishment, of the Western establishment. And we also, particularly with the African Keith and Keen in the United States, we have to work in order to promote this struggle within the context of our just demand for reparations, because it is closely linked.
Kofi Kluwe, on that note, we have to wrap up. If you have a phone number that people can call to get in touch with you, Jubilee 2000.
Well, you can always call. I work I am based in London, United Kingdom. But the Jubilee 2000 Africa campaign has its secretariat in Accra, Ghana. But because, again, the impact of structural makes communications difficult, it's better for people to get in touch with me on telephone number 017.
Make it quick.
1-924-9033, you know, and I will respond.
And we'll put that on the website. Our website is www.democracy.org. Kofi Kluwe of Uhuru and Jubilee 2000, thanks for being with us. Democracy Now! Produced by Jeremy Scahill, Errol Maitland, our technical director. Thanks to Joe Gill in Washington, Julie Drizin, our executive producer. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
I'm Mark.